Oh, I'm sorry. Did I break your concentration?
Somewhere between science and superstition.
We have such sights to show you.
Strange eons. Welcome to Strange Eons Radio. That's Eric over there.
Hello.
Wow, how did you mess up the hello?
That's Vanessa over there.
Hey.
Oh, boy. Here we are, you guys. This is what we're going to be about. Hey, you guys might know me as a cis white male.
Generally.
Although I've always kind of taken offense to these kind of labels, because I think that we all have a lot of sexuality in us, and it goes all sorts of different ways.
It's a spectrum.
And I've got, Eric has known me for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
When
mm-hmm.
I was slimmer, I was mistaken for gay more than once.
Oh, sure.
Okay.
Never had a real problem with it.
I definitely have not had a listener literally tell me, but he's gay.
Oh.
So.
Wow. And, the thing is, I've always thought, you know, I've got a percentage of gay. It is somewhere below 50% because sure. I'm attracted to women. But sure. It could be 49%.
Mm-hmm.
I may have just pushed myself over the edge. A couple of weeks ago, we did our photo shoot, and I mentioned on the air that I got my nostrils waxed, or I waxed my nostrils.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Carlos then hung out with me that night, and I made sure to say, hey, you said nothing about my smooth nostrils, and he was like, what? And I told him about the waxing, and then he said, now, we'd had a couple of bottles of wine.
Uh-oh.
He said, wax mine.
Oh, my God.
And I said, well, I'll show you how to do it. He goes, no, you have to do it. So I heated up the wax.
Nice. Oh, my God.
I stuck it in his nostrils. We waited 90 seconds.
Oh, my God.
I put my foot on the couch. I said, we'll go on three. One, two. I yanked it.
Oh, my God.
He screamed.
See, now, there's some very male humor going on here, too.
He then went into the bathroom and said, I'm bleeding, because I managed to get a little of the wax on his mustache and yanked that out as well. We had a good laugh, and then we went for nostril number two.
Oh, my God.
Oh, so you do one at a time?
You have to do one at a time.
Okay. Oh.
And
plug up your breathing. Come on.
And we laughed so hard afterwards. And then he was just like, wow, this makes a huge difference. So
he's definitely going to get COVID easier.
I waxed my brother from another's nostrils.
And that turned you on?
I wouldn't say it turned me on, but it didn't turn me off.
I will say, you know what? This is a very common rite of passage for girls. Because once you start growing leg hair...
Waxing
leg hair.
Oh, okay.
Off of each other. And being the person to rip it off of the other person for the first time. And I remember attempting one time to do it with a friend of mine. And we did not get it right. And it sucked. And I was like, never again. But the only time I did it was with a friend.
Do you mean, were you doing the waxing or were you the wax?
We did it on each other.
Or wax off.
You take turns because,
on,
you know, the pain.
Okay, but which part didn't go right? Your end?
Yeah, mine. Oh. Like, it was the 90s, so the wax was, like, cheap or whatever, and it didn't stick. So it was just, like, it just sort of,
but not
there
like,
was sticky
not
stuff.
Not like blood.
But no hair came off.
All my hairs really are now standing straight up.
But no, I think that's really charming. That's, like, a very good friendship thing to do.
I would say, if you haven't figured it out, that we've become pretty close.
I guess, yeah, I'm feeling that. And I'm so excited that he's kind of become part of the Strange Eons family.
Yeah. Gay True. Sex is right around the corner as far as I'm concerned.
You should hey, let you, his wife
this will probably
you
become you. A, you this will be you, a man. Surprise to Carlos, but
you do you.
But not to your friend Vanessa, who's clearly caught on to me before everybody else.
Nope. Yep. I'd say there are a fair number of people out there who mistake you for that. I was not one of them, though. I was like, why would you think that Kelly's gay? He talks about chicks all the time.
That's why.
Oh,
all compensating.
I'm so naive.
Right. speaking of chicks, so I've been keeping up with She-Hulk.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, you guys?
One behind. Yep.
Well, maybe this last one turned my mind around a little bit.
Really?
I thought the second episode was really bad and dull and short, like 22 minutes or something.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's a bonus, I guess.
And then this third one I thought was pretty fun. What I don't like, and I feel like this is a misstep on their part, her breaking the fourth wall and talking to the audience. I understand that that is a comedy thing and everything, but when you've already got Deadpool in the Marvel Universe doing that and doing it very well, then taking another character that it doesn't quite fit with is...
It's hard because she does do that, as far as I know, in the comics.
Yeah.
Like, that's a common part of her character, and I think that's why they're trying to do it, but I haven't... It hasn't landed for me either. Like, every time she does it, I'm like, wait, are you aware of us or not? Or, like, why are you aware of us? Why you're not the kind of character who would be aware of us. Like, what is your relationship to us? And that's not clear. And with Deadpool, I feel like it's more obvious and clear. And even if he's either crazy or he sees us, and it doesn't matter which, because of who he is.
Yeah, with Deadpool, I always kind of felt like, you know, if you were standing not in the audience, you would see him turn to the side and speak to an imagined audience.
Totally.
It turns out the comic I just decided to check out is exactly the one this is based on. Because that second episode when the guy talks to her, says, hey, I'd like to talk to you. I own this law firm. I was like, oh, okay. I know exactly what's coming up here next. They did a smart change, though. In the comics, the super, and maybe I don't know if this happens in three, but the super level prison. All of the prisoners are shrunk to teeny tiny little sizes.
Oh, that's funny.
Like little lead figure size. So it's like, this is weird, but probably a good one to not transferred onto the film.
Like they did that as like a way to keep them in, and they shrunk them for real?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
I'm with you.
With the PIM particles. That's
exactly what it was.
Wow.
Jesus.
You can't get into trouble when you're that tiny.
This new episode, you're just keeping your geekdom going layer upon layer.
This is what the listener is looking for. They want this kind of deep dive knowledge that I can offer.
That's right. That's right.
Well, speaking of deep dive, I returned to Riverdale. I'm only at the start of season 5. So I thought I had gotten a lot further in than I had, because we are now, I think, starting the final season of that they're airing, which will be season 8.
Wow.
Yeah. So on Netflix, 5 and 6 and I believe 7 are all there.
Jeez.
Yeah. I'm like, I thought I stopped watching it for a second, guys. It's really interesting because they start the season off. You're still in the high school world, whatever, whatever. And then all of a sudden... they graduate.
Wait a second. What? We're 8 seasons into this and they're still in high school?
No.
What are they in, the 18th grade?
I'm on season 5. So they've graduated, right?
Oh, okay.
And then everybody goes off their separate ways. And now it's 7 years later.
Oh, jeez.
Which is smart and weird because like they don't look any different, but they never really looked like high school age.
Right.
So now they're kind of playing their actual ages.
And they went their separate ways. Now they've come back to Riverdale
to save Riverdale.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. Sure. So it's an interesting, I don't know. I'm a little bummed out because Bughead is no more. The actors broke up. The actress who plays Betty and the actor who plays Jughead. Which for me was like...
They were actually seeing each other?
Yeah.
Oh. And they were called Bughead?
Yeah, that's their... God. That's the just mainstream...
Stop! Just stop!
So,
I wish the sun would just explode right now.
God. TMZ just needs to...
Could be worse.
Go off the air.
So I... So for me, that was one of the main reasons I watched it, because I loved that couple. And now that they're not there, I'm kind of left with other couples I don't give a rat's ass about.
So the... Wait a second. So the characters were seeing each other, and they are not.
And the actors. And now the characters aren't even like in most of the scenes together, and it's very clear they broke up.
When they broke up, they were petty enough that they couldn't continue to work together?
I think it was painful from what I... Because I went online, of course.
Yeah, sure.
To try and figure out what happened, because my heart just got wrenched. And now the actor who's playing Jughead is dating this like super hot model who's really thin and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, but you had Betty.
Well, Betty is gorgeous. I'm sure she'll do fine.
She'll be fine. I'm just sad they aren't together, at least in the show. But it's interesting because I think that it was very painful, but they do still care about each other. So they're still, I'm wondering if as the seasons progress, I'll get to see them in more scenes together because maybe they'll have gotten over it as two actors.
Sure.
But I can tell right now they've obviously just broken up because they are only in scenes together where there is a group and they're always sitting on the opposite sides of the room and they almost never talk to each other. So
just like a real breakup then.
Yeah. So okay. It feels very real, but I am personally hurt. But it's a good season to watch for this episode specifically because that the big bad or the big interesting thing for season 5 is the Mothman.
Oh,
I was just about to say, are they still flirting with horror elements?
They are, and it is alien this time around. I don't know that Mothman was necessarily literally spaceship with white light, but they're playing with that somehow. So I was like, oh, okay.
Can you imagine living a life that has this much shit happening every single year?
Yeah. So tired.
I mean, the kids from Stranger Things would have such bad PTSD after the second year of this happening.
Yeah, sure.
But then, you know, it's always a new thing threatening to destroy the universe. And yeah, they seem to be just fine in between.
This is just my life.
Yeah. Well, this how be, yo. I mean, I guess they have a 7-year break where...
Oh, good point. Where nothing happened.
Nothing happened, for sure. I mean, definitely Archie wasn't in, like, war the whole time and comes back with PTSD.
Wait a second. Did he go off to war?
He went off to military because he didn't get into college or there's some, like, educational plot line.
What year are they supposed to be in now? Do they live in our reality?
I have no idea.
Trying to think of what 7-year war he could have been in.
I know. I think it was just he was overseas in not war, but you know, he saw action.
I see. Okay.
Yeah. And Jughead was a writer and had a big hit, but based off of all the stuff that he was narrating for the whole previous 4 years that we watched him.
Oh, right. I forgot that was always narrated by him. I might have to get into this. I thought this was good trashy fun.
It's good trashy fun. It's great background material when you're doing other things, and I've had to have something.
The only thing that would make me happier is if they get to a point where they're like, look, we're going to have to cancel it. Let's make this last season Afterlife with Archie.
I agree 1,000%, but what, from my understanding, they're doing the last season is that they are, something happens and they're having it all take place in like 1950s Americana, original Archie land.
Whoa.
Like something happened.
Like time travel?
Or? Well, we don't know. And one person knows that this is not right. And I think it's Jughead.
God damn you, Vanessa.
I'm trying to crawl my way back through to you. It's hard though, because you can, so many times you're like, oh, and you're just stealing this. Oh, and you're just stealing this. And you're not even trying very hard. Like there's a trash bag killer. And I'm like, this is literally the scene from Silence of the Lambs. Okay, guys. Like this is really not trying hard, but that's okay.
Next episode, I'm going to be like, okay, so I watched 7 seasons of Riverdale.
Right there with you.
Sounds interesting. I only watched the first season and then just sort of clicked out of you. But yeah, this might be worth returning to. The first season's basically, you know, 90210, straightforward sort of teen drama.
Oh, it just gets weirder and weirder every fucking season. Nice. To the point where like they're trying to outweird themselves. The previous season, I think, followed a cult where they actually launched someone into space.
Like, whoa.
Yes, there's a lot going on.
I mean, I gave up on it. The last season I was watching, I can't remember exactly what was happening. I know that Archie's dad was killed.
Yes. Sure.
But I was just so in love with the girl who plays Veronica. She's so gorgeous.
She's
and
so watchable.
Even that couldn't keep me going on with the show.
She's always fun to watch. And she's sort of such a great actress who just kind of knows her role and makes such a likable character no matter what they have her do. That I've really enjoyed that. But it's unfortunate because I liked what they did with Betty, where they started to make her like crazy and weird and dark around the edges in season 1. But now they're like, she's just dark. And I'm like, could you do anything else with her, please? Just, I beg of you.
Nope. Sorry.
We'll see. I've got 3 seasons ahead of me.
Oh, well, there you go. Okay. Well, so
tangent.
Moving to a very different realm. Watched a film on Shudder called The Righteous.
Oh, okay.
I've not heard of this,
one. This is I'm sure it's a 2022 film that's all black and white. It's got basically three characters in it. And 20-30 minutes in, I'm going, I don't even know if I'm going to finish this movie. By the end, I'm going, fucking glad I did.
Oh, oh wow.
It's just all, it's all interesting story. There's a, it's a couple whose daughter has recently been killed, and a very strange guy in very weird circumstance, very basic, but like, why are you letting this guy into your house? Circumstances shows up. And where it goes from that is really wild to watch. And the performances just absolutely make it. Because if they weren't good, this movie would be really, really bad. So it's sort of like that one storytelling one that you talked about a while ago with the two people sitting in the house trying to scare each other by telling their stories.
Oh, right, right.
That if they weren't good, that movie is nothing. Mm-hmm. This is a, not like that movie, but this is like that movie in that if these three people weren't as good as they are, it would be like, I'm done with this, but damn, it is well done.
The synopsis you gave makes me think that I did read something about this. Does it turn supernatural?
A little. It's got supernatural, but that's not what makes it interesting. It's got a priest who left the priesthood and trying to figure that out, and another priest trying to help him out. But it's not religious at the same time. It's really an interesting story.
Hmm.
I'll put that on the list. I saw something on Netflix that just came out, or a couple of weeks ago. Carter?
Of Mars?
Nope.
Damn.
Of John?
Nope. I think both of you might like this. It's foreign. I don't remember where it's from.
Oh, I don't know. I have to read.
You do have to read, but quite honestly, the dialogue is not why you would watch this movie. It is a series of one take shots, and you can kind of tell that it's not really one take. It's kind of like that hardcore Henry movie, only it is a third person shooter. So you're following this one guy through all of these one take shots. And it is violent and gory. It's like they said, I really want to make a John Wick movie, but with fighting in it.
Not just shooting.
So what's the genre?
Everything. Well, I guess it would be action, but it's so violent and gory. It kind of dips into horror. There's a lot of gunplay, swordplay.
The Raid.
Yeah, a little bit of The Raid in there, too. It is really, it's exhausting. You know, I had to watch it in two tries, but at the end I was like, wow, that was really good. And I know a lot of people like that hardcore Henry movie.
Yeah.
I did not, because of the whole first person view of the camera.
Yeah.
This one is kind of like that, only the camera is just flying all over the place. And I don't know. I kind of liked it.
Cool. That's Netflix, did you say?
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. Carter.
And what country is it originally?
It's an Asian country, and I would hate to not know which it is. And,
that's fine. Don't fill in that blank.
Thanks.
Well, I've been catching up on, I'm so excited, Lower Decks has started back up.
So good.
So good. So I watched episode one, and I think, is there a second one out yet?
Yeah, there's two.
Oh my God, I love it so much because it is so Star Trek. Anytime they try to be like, but maybe it's not Star Trek. Uh-huh. And they're like, no, I've seen this fucking episode of Star Trek elsewhere. It is still Star Trek. So, oh my God, I fucking love the show.
It's great. It's funny as hell. Inventive and interesting in the different ways they approach things. It's really, really well written.
Yeah, extremely well written. I think the first episode really shows that, because it could be very pedestrian if anyone else had done it.
Yeah.
I think that it would be boring and stupid and straightforward. But with this, it's like so perfectly like structured and nicely, I don't know, really eloquent in the way it gets to where it goes. So yeah. You guys should check it out if you like Star Trek. If you don't like Star Trek, well, yeah, check it out. I think you'd still like it.
You might. You might still like.
You might be completely lost on a lot of references, but that's okay.
Yeah, true. So, totally out of genre, I watched something interesting. Years ago, was presented to screen at Issaquah, and we weren't able to get it for some reason. I think it got picked up or something, but it's a documentary about a... it's another one of those, do you go, really? That's what that is about? Okay. About the foremost U.S. maker of handmade pasta.
Of handmade what?
Pasta.
Oh, my God.
Oh.
His name is Funke, I believe is how it's pronounced. It's F-U-N-K-E. And it's the story of him after failing and crashing and burning miserably on the first restaurant he opened. I think it's 5 or 6 years later or more, he's coming back to open another restaurant. And it's the story of opening that restaurant. But it's also the story of, and I love stories like this. I don't care what the subject matter is. It's a story about somebody who loves what they do so much that they give everything they have in them into being the best they can be at it. And he's that way with pasta. He travels back to Italy and talks to some of his original teachers. And it's a ridiculously interesting moment where he talks about his version of a rolling pin he uses, where he visits the place that makes them.
Oh, my God.
And it's that good. It's that Donkey Kong kind of thing, again, where you go, why do I give a fuck? Oh, my. Why do I care about? Oh, okay, that's interesting.
Oh, it's, wow.
And he goes, like, one of the moments he goes to this small Italian city, and there's a woman there making a certain kind of handheld pasta. And she is just like, making it supremely fast. And this super excellent guy's just sitting there looking at her going, I'm never going to be able to do it like that. And he never really does. I mean, she is that good. Wow. It's really neat.
That's so incredible.
What was that called?
It's a guy's name. Funke. F-U-N-K-E.
Isn't that David Cross's name on Arrested Development?
I think it is. I think it is.
What'd you see that on?
Amazon. I believe.
Oh, that's cool that it got picked up. That's nice.
Oh, yeah. It's really good.
Okay, so why don't we take a little break, guys? And then when we come back, we're talking about Eric's pick.
Aliens! They're unstoppable! But we're gonna stop them anyway! Send in the Marines! We're the Space Marines! Drake, Ripley, Apebone, Bishop, and I'm Hicks, armed with the latest high-tech heavy metal.
Look out, Hicks! The Queen's gonna crown ya!
My bug rocker's on a roll!
Full alien attacking!
Eat torch, bug brain!
Alien invasion problem? Send in the Marines!
Aliens!
Send in the Marines!
Space Marines, aliens!
And we're back. Eric, this was your subgenre pick.
Yes.
Which was, what again?
Alien horror.
Vanessa's favorite subject.
Yeah, that's right. Sort of a dick move. I mean, it was a long time ago we did the disco episode. Right. Uh-huh. So, we need...
I didn't think that you could pick something worse, but I did. This was inevitable.
Yes.
And so here we are.
That's right. It was going to happen. So the idea was a little bit came out of Okamika's, which you're sitting there looking at all of these sci-fi films from the 70s, and then looking back on the history of Strange Eons and how many times we've talked about a sci-fi 70s movie, and I thought, hold on, we've never done Alien Prey or Alien Horror. Let's do it. And I did 1978's Prey.
Kator to command ship.
Command ship.
I am now in orbit.
Proceed with mission.
UFOs, fact or fiction? Space explorers are figments of the mind.
You've made contact with human life forms. New identity established.
Are aliens already amongst us?
Command ship.
Command ship.
Their immediate reaction aggressive. Forced to take terminal action.
Continue with mission.
Why are they here?
Success of total operation essential.
For a million years, man was the hunter. Now, he is the prey. Prey. Certificate X.
Oh.
also known as Alien Prey, which made it very hard to find on Rotten Tomatoes.
Oh my God.
Because they don't have it listed as Prey at all, just Alien Prey. I'm like, okay. So then I found it, and I found out there are zero critics. Actually, there's one critic review of it, which was positive. So I guess it's 100% positive. And 30% from the crowd. So I'm guessing the...
Pretty polar.
Yeah, that's all right. This was made on approximately 5,000 or 50,000 pounds in deferred payments and 3,000 cash. This is low budget. No idea what money it made. Directed by Norman J. Warren, who went on to do some films I've heard of. Satan's Slave, Bloody New Year, and Inseminoid. 70s horror weird shit. Max Cuff is the writer, and this is the only film he has listed. So this is it. One and done. And Quinn Donaghy is the lead. His movie is The Triplets. But he went on to be a very successful publicist in Hollywood, working on The Limey, Kingdom of Heaven, Superman 2 and 3, and many, many more.
Wow.
So he stayed around. I think he could have used his publicist skills to get this movie a little more box office gold. The actors in it were, I'm sorry, who is that? Another actor in it, sorry, it was Barry Stokes. Enemy Mine, Hawk the Slayer,
nice.
Space 1999, and Hammer's House of Horror. Sally Faulkner was in Growing Pains, The She-Wolf of London, Vampires with a Y, The Culture Vultures, and Doctor Who, 1968 version. Glory Anon, Supergirl, Felicity, Spaced Out, and Water. So they had a couple, it's pretty much just three performers in this film. There's a few other people that show in and out, but they're about it. So they actually got some people who went on to do a fair amount of work in Hollywood. So this starts out as a family awakening at night by strange lights and noises. What could it be? We don't know because you never actually see it because they had no budget to show you a spaceship. But the next scene is the alien stalking the house with some grunts and strange noises, but the lights are gone. So you know somebody has landed and is coming for their place. The movie then moves forward to a couple in a car. Man leaves to take a pee. Guess what? He ain't coming back. The alien grabs him and you hear these weird little grunts and groans. And then the alien comes forth with this cute little nose. It looks like a fox or a cat or something. It's like, that's like the least scary alien makeup I've ever seen. But the main couple is it's not immediately apparent because they live in separate rooms, so I thought it was maybe a mom and a daughter, but it's a lesbian couple, so they gloss over that at the beginning. But the film does slowly reveal that, because you know, it's 1977. Alien kills like a whole bunch of bunnies. luckily it's off screen and they just find these little bunny bodies. And they say, the lady says, "Oh, it must be a fox." I'm going, you know, you're kind of close.
Not wrong.
So, but he can transform, so he looks like a normal man. And so you've got the 70s idea of a man intruding on women's world and fucking it all up. So they immediately causes major jealousy in one of the two women. Which hints at there's going to be a lot more going on in this movie than just an alien hanging out with some people and killing them. And there really is. There's several scenes of the alien trying to figure out what is the bird in a cage. He doesn't understand the creature there. Whenever he eats any human food, he gets violently ill, except for alcohol. Loves him some champagne. Drinks the hell out of that. So there's a lot of the interacting of him trying to get to know their world and them trying to understand who the hell is this handsome stranger that's come into our lives. Jessica, the younger woman, finds a very strange bunch of stuff at the foot of her bed inside a large box that is bloody clothes. and the world's largest switchblade. She hits the switchblade and it's like the size of her head. Like,
but, so doesn't the handle also have to be that large?
It's huge.
Oh, okay. So you're not hiding this in your back pocket.
No. Okay. No. You're not hiding it in your hand. You're just like, hey, why are you carrying a small sword? I can figure the prop. That's all the props department could find that looks, I want a switchblade. Okay. Thump. All right. I'll use that. So this implies that the other woman killed her father.
Oh.
And is hiding that in the back. I mean, it's not immediate appearance of father, but there's other things that are said that imply that her father was living with them at some point and he just went away. It's very subtly introduces that this is an incredibly abusive relationship that she's in. Mm. And like, whoa, why did not see that one coming? Huh. And boy, is she ever. She is awful. And they decide a fox attacks and kills their chickens, I believe it is. So the abusive lady loses her mind and tries to go out and hunt the fox down. Can't find it. The alien does, though, of course, because, mm-hmm. He sniffs it out and brings it back and drops it on the table in front of the two women. And they're both like, yay, let's have a celebration and do a party and I'll make a cake and we'll celebrate the killing of the fox that's laying on our chess table.
Beautiful. Like, okay, definitely is not covered in insects. Sure.
The other lady gets a little suspicious, though, when she finds the fox later on and there's nothing left but the skin. So
yummy fox.
Yeah.
Love it.
But so Joe is the older lady, continues to definitely have problems with the alien and gets more and more abusive with Jessica. It starts with verbal abuse and works up to some pretty horrific physical abuse. So the film is so much more than it looks like, especially going, this is a Vinegar Syndrome release. So I was expecting little fox alien does stupid shit.
Yeah.
But it's actually a fairly well done film with some really, really dark edges and a fairly good ending. It was pretty good. I was really surprised because, again, Vinegar Syndrome is, you expect something very specific from them. And there was a lot of that because there is no budget in this movie. And
how much was the budget?
$50,000 deferred, but $3,000 in cash.
Wow.
£50,000.
Yeah.
Vanessa, you lived in London. How many ounces is that?
When I lived in England for the 10 years, that was double the US dollar, but that is not normal.
Okay. Oh, wow.
That would not have been what it was in the time that you're talking about.
1977?
1977 yeah, was very different.
Not time. So much, yeah. So the taglines. His savage hunger makes us all alien prey.
Ah, I get it.
When I first started this film, I was like, okay, this is going to be a boring movie because it starts like, all right, what's going on? So I decided I'd look up and find out how many films have the word prey in them. According to IMDb, there's 1,097 films that have the word prey.
Good Lord.
Next subgenre pick, film called Prey.
Yeah, that's right. It was a pain in the ass at times looking this movie up. Now, what was the year again? Oh, yeah. But and this is a UK production, too, as you know, pounds and stuff. Mm-hmm. Most of the script was written while they were shooting.
Oh, good.
Warner agreed to shoot the film in 10 days.
Oh, my God.
That gave him only 3 weeks of pre-production. Shot largely with handheld cameras. And whoever the handheld cameraman was in this was good. Mm. I did not immediately go, oh, this is handheld. And even after knowing it was almost all handheld, I'm watching this going upstairs and around stuff. You know, this is not, this budget did not have, it's about the time Steadicam was starting. So there's no way they're affording to use a Steadicam at any time. So this is true handheld.
Wow.
So should have looked up who it was because they were really good. Let's see. Filming commenced after they did half a day of rehearsal with the actors in the location and didn't have a finished script and averaged 35 camera setups a day.
Wow.
I am amazed the film they pulled off considering all of that because it is, I mean, it's low budget. It's still a Vinegar Syndrome level release in a lot of ways, but there's just so much more going on here and the Most of the acting is really good. Well, I hit that hard. But one of the Joe, the abusive lady, goes way over the top at times.
Just, sure.
Apparently the bird that he was obsessed with was Wally. He's a cockatoo that often refused to perform when they needed him to and spent a lot of time off camera squawking and making loud noises. He eventually escaped and was never seen from again.
That sounds exactly like a cockatoo.
Yeah, exactly.
Jesus.
There is a very, very strange almost drowning scene in this where the alien goes into a little bog and doesn't know how to swim. So he starts thrashing around and the ladies go out to film him. Two weird things in this, at least two. This water is nasty as hell.
Oh, God.
They ended up giving everybody injections for tetanus and all that stuff to protect them from it. It looks like watered down oil almost. Oh. It's really nasty. They shot it in slow motion, so they didn't have to be there as long. And when it was done, the director made a note to the editor saying, if you cut a single frame of this, I will fire you from editing the rest of the movie. So it is ridiculously long, it's kind of funny. It's just like, yeah, you should have let your editor work on this a little bit. It probably would have been an interesting scene, but as it is, it's like minutes long of this guy going, thrashing around. I mean, although it's really gross, it looks like water you could probably stand up in.
Sure.
So this leads me to the question.
Yes.
What is the alien a mask? A puppet?
He's a human, but when he turns into the little foxy looking thing,
yeah.
That's all. It's just they've got some eye contacts, a prosthetic on the nose.
And okay.
It's like a Star Trek.
You said a cute fox nose, and I was like, is this a puppet they're doing this with? No, so just a person
they
with
poked
a little...
his nose up a little bit and made a cute little thing. They probably waxed his nose.
Sure. Well, yeah.
Since it was showing up, you know. So that scene is ridiculous. Everybody lives, though, so I guess it's all right. there's also a fairly bloody scene at the end where they didn't let the nude performers know that in order to keep the real animal parts fresh, they've been frozen. So they throw frozen meat onto them.
Ouch.
That's so good.
Yep. So
very stiff.
Yeah.
Stiff looking meat.
Jim Reed of the Psychotronic Film Society of Savannah, Georgia says, Prey finds unexpected vantage points for subtle commentary on the themes of sexism, love, adultery, betrayal, and racism, all within the context of a gay alien zombie vampire gore fest.
Wow.
Good Lord.
I would remove vampire from that because I'm not sure where the vampire came in, but all the rest is fairly accurate.
Wow. That guy got a lot out of this movie.
yes, he did. Peter Hutchings considered the film bizarre, but adds that the sustained seriousness of Warren direction in the doom-filled atmosphere saved frame from becoming a piece of camp nonsense, which is also true. It's so much better than I thought it was going to be.
Cool.
So all of you that are going to go watch this movie sucks. It's terrible. Now you can enjoy it.
Oh, man. Okay. Well, I watched a film that is pretty obscure. It's a 1977 movie called Foes.
Music, but with menace. They came not as friends, but as foes.
General, the object has moved.
What?
It's changed position. Have him turn back immediately.
Base command to rescue unit. Do not approach the island. Turn back at once.
We decided it's huge. This shape. Goddamn, it's real, all right.
If you've had a close encounter, you might not be ready for another. But it's exactly those who are not ready who get caught.
Island, sealed off, impenetrable.
But why? For what?
Probes. For recon, study, observation.
For an enemy to be destroyed, it must first be identified. But all those who get too close have an encounter of the fourth kind, the permanent kind. lose.
Well, they want to take us away in that thing. What if they try to hurt us?
Diane.
You don't know what it is, what's inside.
Man has conquered the sky, but from the sky now comes a force to conquer man. They are not afraid to be seen, but will you be afraid to see them?
There's been an explosion on the island.
Explosion?
A tremendous surge of heat and radiation.
What began as a frightening possibility ends as a terrifying reality.
Signals are from the UFO.
We must make you wait to see what they are, but we can show you how they came. And remember, they came not as friends, but as foes.
FOES?
I'm not familiar.
Me either.
Yeah,
this one.
It's a weird one. And foes, as in, I believe, UFOs.
I got it.
I say it's obscure. There is no budget or box office available. There is no Rotten Tomatoes available. And there's no Wikipedia page.
Wow.
Yeah. It is really
Sounds
hard
like
to...
you're dipping into the field I usually go into.
I know. I was very proud of myself in this. I don't know. I watched this. The only way to watch this that I found, aside from specially ordering the DVD, was watching it in full on YouTube.
There you go.
For free. So that's a good way to do it. It's even an okay copy. Trailer for it sucks. So don't base it off of that, because I definitely was very close to not watching it. However, I came across it because it was in the list of like films that may have inspired Nope. Jordan Peele's Nope.
Oh, wild.
Yeah. Okay, so written and directed by, and acted in by John Coates. He has one credit to his name. It is this. However, as a special effects guy, he has 49 credits to his name, including Adventures in Babysitting, UHF, New Nightmare, Deep Blue Sea, Red Planet, Rambo 3, The Host, not that one, Clash of the Titans, Tenacious D, Pick of Destiny, et cetera, et cetera. He's done a ton of incredible work.
Wow.
And he is definitely utilizing that in this film. It is starring people who've only ever been in this film.
Oh, no.
McDonald Carey, who's been in 117 things, including 3,080 episodes of Days of Our Lives.
Wow.
Wow.
Who's in Shadow of a Doubt, Suddenly It's Spring, Comanche Territory, and a lot of TV walk-on roles. And Jerry Hardin, who plays the general in this. He's been in 168 things, including Big Trouble in Little China, The Firm, Cujo, and 11 episodes of X-Files as Deep Throat.
Oh, okay.
Cool.
Yeah. So, like, there's kind of like, oh, okay. Weirdly, he's pretty awful in this film. He's like, every time he speaks, I'm like, oh, buddy, no. Like, try a little harder. The acting has got a lot to... It sucks. All right. The plot. An American fighter jet reads something off of its radar. This guy keeps kind of looking at a beeping, deet, 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 and you're like, man, for like a pretty low ass budget movie, I'm surprised how good this looks already. There's a lot of aerial shots of clouds. So it's kind of a POV of something and you're not really sure what it is, but like you are up there in the clouds and there's, you know, the thing is coming closer and closer and closer. And then, of course, there's a giant crash. The jet, the U.S. jet plane explodes into fireworks because, of course, they're miniatures. NORAD is called, and they track where this strange, unidentified spacecraft has moved to. And it's kind of slightly moved off course from where the crash site is to a nearby island, which houses only a lighthouse and two lighthouse keepers, or at least the lighthouse keeper and his wife, who have like a little residence out there. They see the large spaceship sitting off the ocean, off of the cliffs, and they're like, cool, They just don't care. Like, they're just kind of standing there looking at it. It's very, like, 70s, like, how I imagine, I don't know, like, everyone's just chill about everything. They're just like, huh, all right, I guess I should call it in, huh? So, I mean, like, the lighthouse keeper goes to call it in, but, of course, there's some weird frequency going on that's surrounding the island, and he cannot make any kind of communication. And NORAD, who is trying desperately to contact them to say, get off this island, can't get a hold of them either. So he kind of goes into the house, roots around, gets his camera, takes a Polaroid of it, looks at the Polaroid. We don't see the Polaroid. I don't know whether he got the shot or not. Mystery. That stuck with me. And then he goes back in, and him and his wife, like, she's really worried about it. Like, she's kind of fretting a lot. They don't let her talk a lot, thank God, because she is awful. But whenever they just film her face looking like confused or worried or sick or anything like that, that's fine. Just don't let her talk. He's worried about some radiation, so they try to go into the lighthouse to look at it, where there's thicker walls, and from there he, you know, takes some measurements, and he's like, yeah, I think that this is 150 feet across. And then he's kind of intrigued, and he's like, he watches as the spaceship lands somewhere on the other side of the island, and it was maybe like a, you know, hour walk away or something. So it's a long island, but it's not like big. And he's like, you know what? I'm going to go check it out. And she's like, ugh. And he's like, you don't have to come. She's like, I'll come. He's like, you don't have to. And she's like, I'll come. And so she grabs a gun and puts it in her pants. That's fine. Meanwhile, two divers have taken a boat off to explore some underwater caves under the island. So when they're down there, all of a sudden the water starts shaking like crazy. The UFO has created this crazy earthquake. I can't remember if it's like just making some waves, or I don't remember why it did it. But anyway, so they're like, oh, crap, something's weird. So they swim back out to their boat and discover that it's completely fried. Anything with a motor is fried. NORAD is also trying to get to this island. They've sent in a helicopter, which basically just dies outside of the island. Like, it hits the field and drops.
Oh, shit.
But they don't seem concerned. Like, they don't make it sound like the guy's dead who drove it. And then he's like, they're like, we'll try the helicopter again later. And I'm like, that seems like a bad choice, guys. Okay, fine.
It's okay. We've got plenty.
Right, yeah. Just hose it off from the former guy who was inside it. We'll just start over.
You know, like, put a rope around it, bring it back to shore, and try it again in a bit. They're also trying to get the Coast Guard to go in, but the ships, as soon as they hit this magnetic field, everything just dies. So they have no other options, apparently, because they don't want to row to the island, I guess. I know that this is an option because that is what the two divers do when they discover that their boat is fried. They get into it and start to row to the island, like the little life dinghy. I'm like, oh, cool, okay. So meanwhile, the couple gets to the area where the guy thought he saw the ship landed and tries to look around for it. Can't quite find it. It's not really sure. But all of a sudden, it pops up and is above them. And there's a big light beam. And there are some crazy looking effects of people like going off into space where they're just clearly standing somewhere or maybe jumping off a thing and superimposed on it. But at one point, like, somebody's in a fetal position. They just spin their way up into space.
Oh my.
It is amazing. However, the couple are both caught in this beam, and for some reason it lets go of the girl a little sooner than the guy. So she lands on the ground and she's covered in like fucked up burns. He lands on the ground and he is a corpse covered in like little bits of flesh. He's just a skeleton with completely charred. So whatever this stuff is, this radiation is crazy. Humans are not prepared for these aliens. That is for sure. But the aliens are very curious about the humans. So two divers wander onto the island trying to figure out what's going on. They're trying to get help because they don't know about the UFO. They find the radio's dead, and then they wander around the island and find the corpse of Larry, the lighthouse guy, also known as the director.
Oh, okay.
They find the wife covered in burns. They carry her to the residence and tend to her wounds, but she has no ability to really tell them what's going on. She's just like kind of going in and out of consciousness. And again, thank God they don't let her talk. It would not help. So... Yeah, so we keep going back and forth between this story and what's going on at NORAD. And it is kind of interesting because there's a lot of exposition, but at least when they go to NORAD, it's like they're being interviewed by other branches of the government. So they're explaining what's happening. And you feel like it's justified, even though it is a bunch of exposition of something we already saw and they've already mentioned like five times. But that's okay. Like, I was okay with it. Meanwhile, night falls, the two divers are hanging out in the house. And they see out in this distance, it's pretty creepy, these two long strands of light. And you can kind of work out that these are the alien beings. They're just these tall, long, skinny pieces of light. And they're just kind of hovering around, moving around. They walk out to see what it is. They're like, somebody's out there. I'm like, no, it's not. Don't go out there. And man, they do not have the budget for shooting at night, but they sure do it anyway. There's a lot of black shots, and occasionally you see a face and you're like, what is this? Who is this? And then you have no clue where anyone is, what is happening. But they do sit down in the dirt for a minute, and all of a sudden the lights flicker on and the beings kind of walk around them and then flicker off, and they're like, we got to get the fuck off this island. So will they get off the island? Will the UFO light beings find them and torture them and chase them around the beach?
It's an oddly specific question.
Yes. Will there be a never-ending, but you have no idea what's going to happen next, ending where you're not quite sure if it's ended yet and it keeps going and there's lots of tense music and sometimes you think that they're off the island, but then you're worried that they never got off the island, but you're not really sure. And it's not a smart enough movie to do that to you. So you're just really confused. And there's flashbacks, four scenes you just saw. There might be.
I always love that.
Uh-huh. We shall
remember when.
So this film, you know, the pace is pretty slow, but it does feel deliberate in a way. And I think it actually works for it. It is a weird sci-fi film. It's really low budget. But I think the people who are editing it were kind of geniuses because the way that they're cutting from and to different things really helps the story. I think that this entire story was made in post-production because they found a way to use those actors pretty much without them speaking, which is incredible. They did a lot of showing, not telling. There were tons of great shots of this weird UFO moving around. They also used music to really fill in all the emotional gaps and tell us kind of what we're meant to be feeling, and sound design. And that just really helps this film along. The one thing it doesn't help, though, when you're recutting a film to try and make something out of nothing, geography is not your friend. I have no idea where anyone is. This ship and the aliens, I don't know if the aliens are 7 feet tall. I don't know if they are 200 feet tall. I cannot tell you from the way that this is shot. It is impossible to say. You're like, are you? There's just no context. And when there is context, you're like, is it like they're nearby or are they far away? And I cannot tell. But obviously the director knows a lot about, he did a great job with the VFX because the aliens and the ship design, which are both kind of crazy, really work in a low budget but good way. The ship, they really sell it in interesting ways where, like, when it goes above people, it has a completely reflective surface. So it looks like a mirror. So you see the bottom reflected back up again. And it just looks cool. And then when it goes around cliffs and stuff like that, they actually do put the shadow of where the ship would be onto the cliffside. When it goes through moonlight, you see that effect work again. They do a really great, I don't know, I was impressed by it. And then the aliens, they're interesting for sure. Like, it's a cool design. I don't understand how they talk a lot about magnets and electros and radiation and all kinds of stuff in this film that they clearly have no idea what they're talking about, but that's fine. There was a lot of creepiness. So the sounds that the alien makes did kind of remind me of Nope, actually, because it does sound like either like a chorus or like people screaming.
Oh,
it's
cool.
Weird. And you're not sure what there's a design in the light and it kind of looks like faces, but you can't tell. It's really unsettling. And I like the idea that in this film, people are really fragile and they are just breakable toys. And these aliens are just like, we're here and we want to check it out. And we're just going to play with you. Like, if a dog gets a rabbit in its mouth, like it doesn't know that it's about to murder it. It's just having a good time. Trivia. The director originally asked Orson Welles to star, but he turned it down.
What?
Shocking.
He was doing so much great work in 1977.
Yep. But yeah, still really out of the league of this movie. It was barely released anywhere outside of a minor British run from Satan's slave distributor Brent Walker and US TV airings. Foes got a special edition Blu-ray treatment in 2019 from Garage House Pictures. It includes two versions of the film, both never before available in the U.S. One is an original director's cut, which is approximately 73 minutes long. The other is the theatrical version, which is 91 minutes long.
Jeez.
So I guess the director was nicer to it, like cutting it down, I guess. I don't know. I feel like I watched the director's version. It also includes new commentary where John Coates shares plenty of stories about the shooting of Foes. I did not see it this way, so I have no idea what that was like. I bet it's very lovely. I watched it on YouTube, but it is also on demand from Alamo On Demand. There are three reviews of this film on Amazon. One 4-star review, which kind of nicely sums it up, by Steve Behrens. Don't come to Foes expecting professional actors, a big production budget, or traditional story arc. You'll be disappointed if you do. But this little-known indie movie provides a strangeness, atmosphere, and imagery. Another 4-star review says, read that guy's review, which is actually a lot longer. I just kind of truncated it. And then there is a 2-star review from an quote-unquote Amazon customer that says, movie stinks, don't waste your money. So nice. It's really divisive is what I'm taking away from
this. It sounds like you liked it, though.
I liked it enough. It didn't have traditional aliens in it, and I was really happy about that. Eric, look, okay, so when I was picking this movie, I watched like 7 or 8 trailers for different alien movies, and I had nightmares all night long.
Wow.
All night long. The fact that I know if I see a little thing, it will haunt me if I think about it is not cool. And I have a closet and I keep looking in the closet and I'm like, there's an alien in there for sure. It is watching me for sure. And like, I will get up in the night, check, make sure there's no alien in there. I have a little Hawaiian like protection doll in there. I am trying to be on it. I closed the closet partway into the night. It did not help. So thanks for that.
Wow. Well, okay.
But yeah, Foes, interesting. If you are interested in alien films or alien horror, I think it's a really interesting take on it from the 70s.
I kind of want to put that on my list, but of course I have 7 seasons of Riverdale to get through.
Yeah, you messed up that possibility.
You got to prioritize.
Okay, well, so then I liked this topic because it allowed me to revisit a movie I remember liking a lot, and I was right. From 1988, The Blob.
If it had a mind, you could reason with it. If it had a body, you could shoot it. If it had a heart, you could kill it. Now, man is no longer the supreme being on this planet.
The organism is growing at a geometric rate. By all accounts, it's at least 1,000 times its original mass.
Nobody believes me about what happened tonight.
What did happen?
You were there, you saw.
Plasmic life form that hunts its prey. Predator.
I want that organism alive.
I think you ticked it off.
The Blob. Terror has no shape.
Oh my God, that movie is so fucking good.
Yeah,
it was really good again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good.
A budget of maybe $10 million, maybe $19
million. Oh.
Hard to say, but that doesn't matter because the box office was right about $8
million. There you go.
Rotten Tomatoes critics have it at 63%, the audience at 56%. It seems awfully low to me. I'm not sure why, because I know this has become kind of a lost classic, and I would think that current reviews would have brought this up a little bit. I don't know why it's so low. Maybe I should get on there and write a stellar review for
it. There you go.
Directed by Chuck Russell, who directed The Mask, Nightmare on Elm Street 3, The Dream Warriors, which is why I watched that when I was talking about it last episode. He also directed Eraser and The Scorpion King, so he's had some good success.
Yeah.
It was written by Chuck Russell and Frank Darabont.
Oh, my.
Who would go on to write and direct The Mist, The Green Mile, Shawshank Redemption, and co-create The Walking Dead as a TV show. It stars Shawnee Smith. 71 credits. I remember her best from the movie Summer School, which is an absolute guilty pleasure of mine. I love that movie. She was also in the Stand miniseries, and I didn't realize this, Saw 1 through 4.
Mm-hmm.
She is so pretty in this movie that it's ridiculous. It also stars Kevin Dillon. He has 56 credits. He was in Platoon, No Escape, Poseidon, and 96 episodes of Entourage. And then just a list of that guy's. It's like, oh, it's that guy, Jeffrey DeMunn. Oh, it's that guy, Candy Clark. Oh, it's that guy, Paul McCrane, Art LaFleur. Bill Moseley has a very, very brief moment in this.
Cool.
So the story starts off, and we meet our protagonists in very different ways. Meg, Shawnee Smith, is a high school cheerleader. She's seeing the captain of the football team. The way we meet her is she's cheering during the school game and all of that stuff, and she's making eyes at the football captain and all that. And then we meet Brian, who's Kevin Dillon. He's a loner daddy. He's got long, shaggy hair. He rides a beat-up motorcycle, and we meet him as he's trying to take his motorcycle and jump this broken-down bridge that we kind of see it must be something he's wanted to do for a while. His bike shits out on him just before it happens, and he goes crashing down the ravine. So anyway, this meteor crashes in the woods outside of their small town of Arborville. Now, if you go onto Wikipedia, it's going to be Arborville, California, but it is clearly not Arborville, California. It is somewhere in Colorado or something like that, and it's supposed to be. It's not supposed to be California.
Small town.
And this kind of vagrant guy who was wandering in the woods comes upon it, decides he has to touch it in horror movie fashion. Why you would come across a meteor, which has got to be, you know, very radioactive and hot and feel like you got to poke it with a stick. I don't know. But he does Boys. Poke it with a stick, and he is immediately attacked by this tiny slimy blob, which starts eating through his hand.
Ooh.
Meg and her boyfriend, who are driving home from the football game, they come across him and Brian. Brian has run into him in the woods, and he's trying to help him, but the guy is screaming and walking away from him, and he walks right out into the middle of the road where Meg and her boyfriend almost hit him, and they all decide they got to rush this guy to the hospital. When they get him there, they put him in this room, and they try to deal with the nurses and doctors who are reluctant to deal with this guy because he has no insurance.
Of course.
When he finally convinces this doctor, who is played by, now I can't remember his name. He was in War of the Gargantuas, and he was in Twin Peaks. He's the guy, they found her wrapped in plastic. He's that guy.
Oh, the fish in the percolator?
Yes. I can't remember his name. Famous. I think he was in the original West Side Story even. But he's the doctor, and he finally goes in and goes to take a look at this vagrant who has been dissolved from the arm up, basically. He's basically a chest with one arm and his head, and this blob is nowhere to be seen, which is interesting. Meg's boyfriend goes into this office to call his folks or something like that. It doesn't really matter because he's this good-looking, football team guy. He's supposed to be the hero of this story, obviously. And the blob drops on him. It's much bigger now. It's on the ceiling. And it starts dissolving him in a pretty spectacular way.
Yeah.
Mm.
In fact, when Meg comes in, he is reaching towards her from inside the blob. And this is the movie poster art that we're all very familiar with the dissolved skin and the eyes and all this stuff. It's a great, great shot. The overall effects in this movie are really surprisingly strong. There are a couple of scenes where you can tell there's some kind of rear projection going on, and that's always, you know, kind of shaky. You can see the edges of everything. But otherwise, there's some really neat things that they do with air cannons and, you know, just some really gruesome gore effects. It's really, really cool. And quite honestly, this movie, the reason to watch this is for these effects.
Oh, yeah.
Acting is awesome. A little shaky and the story is a little silly and all that. But the effects still hold up wonderfully. Of course, Meg's boyfriend's death is somehow blamed on Brian, the town bad boy. So a lot of this film is him on the run from the sheriff, even though Meg is trying to explain to everyone that he didn't do anything. But this is about the point where I realized I love what they've done here, what Chuck and Frank Darabont have done here, because Meg is clearly the protagonist in this film. She is the hero of this movie, and the bad boy, she ends up rescuing him a number of times through this because he keeps getting himself in trouble, and she's the one who's actually able to get him out of it. They finally meet up at the local diner to discuss how they're going to deal with this, because nobody really believes them, what they're talking about. But while they're there, one of the employees is attacked by the blob that comes up through a big, huge industrial sink. However, this sink's drain is still only the size of a regular drain, and it shoots out of there, grabs the dishwasher, and then pulls him through this small drain. Oh. It is very gruesome. Really graphic. They show everything. In fact, they show the pipe underneath the sink suddenly bulge with part of him. And I was like, wow, I forgot how great this film is. So they're able to escape that by hiding in the diner's freezer, which, of course, is cold, and the blob starts coming in under the door and then retreats, and they realize, oh, it's afraid of cold temperatures. But they can now see that the blob is growing exponentially because it practically fills up the entire kitchen that they were in now. So it goes, shoots down into the pipes again. While they're trying to figure out what to do and getting away, they're in the woods to try and escape, they come across this military operation near the meteor landing site. And that's when we're told that this was actually, so I kind of, I screwed up on this alien terror because this was actually a space amoeba that hitched a ride on a falling satellite. And also the, very, rote and tropey, military people are like, the townspeople are expendable because we just need to capture this and turn it into a military experiment. So, it is then revealed that the whole thing is our fault because it really was a military experimental virus that we shot up into space in the first place. Mm. And then this this weird space amoeba kind of latched onto it, which was nothing and would have been fine until it latched onto our thing. And they both mutated while up in space and became this thing.
I think it still works. Yeah, okay. Because the space amoeba is still an amoeba.
I guess so. So Brian and Meg are separated. She's gone off to help her kid brother and his friend, Eddie, who she was supposed to be babysitting. And they all end up hiding in the sewers. So Brian has gotten there by being chased by the military, which has a great scene of him on motorcycle. They're chasing after him on these little quads. But they've also got a helicopter, and he realizes, oh, shit, here I am at that bridge. And he, you know, he has his moment. He jumps the bridge. At first, I was like, okay, that's cool, except you've also got a helicopter.
Yeah.
And they take care of that, too, because he hides in this gigantic pipe that's just big enough for a motorcycle to ride through.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
Holy shit.
Yes. Having worked in various construction and land surveying, I always kind of scoff at these things because these things do not exist, especially in small towns. But you know, your average sewer pipes are 12 inches, so you couldn't even fit a turtle in there, Vanessa.
But the little turtles you could.
I suppose.
They're really cute.
Meg and her brother and the other kid, they have also ended up hiding in the sewers. But what they don't seem to realize is the blob is traveling through the sewers. And there is this amazing scene of child endangerment where she's dragging the kids through the sewer, and the blob starts coming towards them, you know, and all that stuff. And one of the kids gets grabbed by the blob, and he has a pretty gruesome, sizzling death inside the blob. I was like, that kid was 11 years old, and they just showed us getting killed by the blob.
This is a rated R?
It is rated R.
Yeah.
There's all the typical stuff of the sheriff finally realizing that Brian isn't a bad dude, but then the sheriff is killed immediately after that. there is a great part with a military scientist who was saying everybody was expendable. He dies in an appropriately gory death. And that finally is what lets the other soldiers go, fuck it. We are not capturing this thing. Let's light it up. We are killing the shit out of this thing. And then there is this great climax where Brian is going to destroy the blob. He gets caught in this bus that the blob is on top of. So Meg, she puts it together that for some reason there is an awfully large cryo tank of dry ice or something, you know, that she's standing on top of. I'm like, I don't think they, it's like the size of a gigantic propane tank. You know, I'm talking 1,000-gallon propane tank, something you would see on the back of a truck, only it's here on the street.
You know,
convenient.
Halloween parties. What can I say? You need a lot of dry ice.
Seems unlikely, but I'm okay with it because she then jumps up, starts shooting the blob with a machine gun while she's on top of it, and she's got grenades, which she jams into this into the housing of this big, huge tank, and the blob then comes to get her, and she escapes, and it blows up and turns the blob into ice cubes. But I was like, that is totally the hero's moment, right?
Oh, yeah. You're right. I never thought about her as the protagonist,
she's
but you're right.
She's absolutely the hero in all of this.
And she has the change. Like, yeah, 100%. Yeah.
Also, she's smoking hot. I mean, she is. I remember thinking she was pretty, but I'm looking at this going, this girl is gorgeous. Wow. It's just a very satisfying movie. It's got a silly little tacked on ending that I was okay with, where the town preacher who's been burned by a flamethrower, we see him now preaching in a tent revival out in the middle of nowhere, and he's preaching the coming of, you know, the blob. It's okay.
That's fun.
Yeah. A couple of taglines. One of them bothers me a lot.
Okay.
Scream now while there's still room to breathe.
Okay, fine.
Sure. Room to breathe.
Like, as in, because it's going to come in and, like, fill your lungs.
Yeah, okay.
All right.
I like this one, though. Terror has no shape.
There you go.
Fun. That's fun.
Okay. Trivia. This was released 30 years after the original version of The Blob and had a budget estimated to be almost 80 times the original.
And a pace probably about 80 times the original.
I like that original one. Steve McQueen was in it. They have some
such
fun.
Such a nerd. He's such a nerd.
Yes, they have some He's fun effects in there. My favorite is the diner, which is clearly just a picture of a diner that they have pushed the blob over. I love that scene.
It's a fun film. It's not great, but it is a fun film.
Yeah.
Dude, there's
and
a
it's
scene
got the great,
where we watch.
Beware of the blob. Okay. It creeps. It leaps. All
the song
stuff.
Is really good, but watching Steve McQueen literally tie his shoes, take them off, put them back on, and go out of a window in real time was not worth it.
I didn't write this down, but I did read that they approached his son to be in this.
And
he was like, come on, guys. It's a little too on the nose.
Nice.
Screenwriter Frank Darabont first met director Chuck Russell in 1981 while working as a production assistant on the film Hell Night.
Oh.
Yeah.
Before working together on The Blob, the two also collaborated on the script for Nightmare on Elm Street 3.
There you go.
Darabont. The big stunt with Brian jumping the ravine on his motorcycle while a helicopter flies overhead and a truck crashes was all captured in camera with all of those elements actually in the shot.
Jeez.
Both tires blew out on the motorcycle when it landed, and the stunt double, quote, held the bike up with his upper body strength and his fucking feet, according to Chuck Russell.
Wow, Jesus Christ.
Nice.
There's a pretty gruesome scene with a partially dissolved soldier. In the trivia I found, the partially dissolved but still alive soldier was performed by stuntman Noble Craig, a triple amputee who lost both legs, an arm, and an eye while serving in the Vietnam War.
Wow.
We thank you for your service.
No kidding.
And then finally, Joe Lynch recalls that the end credits during the film, or not during the filming, but during the first showings, used to feature a disclaimer at the end saying, "The Blob contains a purely fictional account of a group of ruthless and corrupt military agents. These characters do not represent the United States government, and it would be erroneous and unfair to suggest they do. The vast majority of North American Armed Forces personnel have demonstrated the utmost moral sense, regard for civilian welfare, and worthiness of the public trust."
Oh,
needed some military stuff for the film there.
I have the feeling that they put that in as a sarcastic thing and were forced to take it out after probably a few military servicemen saw it. Really, really loved this. Hard to find.
Oh, really?
What?
Well, I mean, it's not streaming.
Oh, I guess. I mean, I have a Scream Factory copy.
I have a regular DVD of it.
Oh,
which I had to break out. But luckily, I have a Blu-ray player now.
Yeah, I was going to say, you should definitely get a hold of a copy of the Blu-ray because it's awesome looking.
Yeah, I'll bet it is. I was, like I said, really surprised by how well the stunts held up. Not the stunts, but the effect held up, because there's a scene where there's a woman in a phone booth, the old style phone booth, that you close the door and get in. The Blob gets in underneath her. The way they shot that was they created a dummy of her, and then they filled this thing with the jelly that they used for the Blob, which I guess was pretty gross, noxious stuff to work with. But then they put air cannons all around the thing, and they shot that in, and the Blob just exploded her inside. God. And it is a really great effect.
Wow. So,
yeah, I really loved this. This was – I think moved – down to LA, or maybe I had just moved back from LA, but it was one of the first movies I saw in either direction of that, and I was really, really happy with it. It was like, oh, cool. This was a good movie to be here for.
I saw a few years ago, and it's amazing how many of the things you mentioned just show up in full color memory because they are so well done in that movie.
Yeah, I'm a little surprised at that 56% because it is it's a solid movie. So the horror fans should really love this.
That's so weird.
You think it'd have a little bit more of the, you know, Halloween 3 effect or something like that. Now that it's been several years afterwards and people look back and go, you know what? This was actually
Of those movies that gets brought up on remakes that are better than the original. I feel like people know about it, but they're just not going back and retroactively reviewing this movie.
Yeah, that's probably what it is. I feel like that's often the case when you see any film that's older than Rotten Tomatoes. You're like, huh, how come the audience doesn't like this movie from the 60s? It's probably because only a couple people are going on there and saying something.
Anyway, great choice, I thought, Eric. Sorry about your nightmares, Vanessa, but here's a perfect chance for you to get back at him.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to get back at you by not having an alien topic. Step one.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I hadn't really thought through the idea of revenge, so maybe for the next cycle. But in the meantime, I was thinking, you know, I love movies that take place in the place where I grew up. And, you know, not hometown horror necessarily, but a genre film that takes place near or in your hometown. So wherever you kind of either
that'll be interesting for me.
Exactly.
I think there's a movie called Twin Falls, Idaho, but I don't know. It's not definitely not a genre.
Yeah. Well, if there's a nearby city otherwise, like, so for example, if I didn't have one for where I grew up, which I do, I could do Malignant for Seattle or, you know, what's the nearest by like city that might kind of reflect your
Can I say maybe we can pop in if it was shot there, not necessarily place there, because I'm sure stuff
shot or take place
been shot in Idaho. You know, all those films that take place in hell have to have been shot somewhere.
Yeah. Twin Falls, Idaho. There's Bruce Willis has a movie that was shot in Twin Falls, but that's definitely not a genre. He's a car salesman.
You know, maybe we can. Can we open?
I'll
this
figure
to,
it out. There's a couple Idaho movies.
Okay, perfect. I think I've got one in mind already.
Awesome.
So located in or shot like. Twin Falls, Idaho is actually nothing to do with Twin Falls, Idaho.
Sure.
It's just the title.
Yeah.
I think it's a Gus Van Sant film. But mm-hmm. so it's either shot in there or like it could be shot in Vancouver, but based in.
Totally. Either okay. shot in there or set in there. Whatever makes sense for your location. Because sure. there's definitely, right, there's a lot of stuff that's shot in Seattle that does not take place in Seattle and definitely vice versa, right? It takes place in Seattle. We definitely shot here at all and it's not Vancouver.
It's not Vancouver.
The entire
X-Files. That's the Space Needle. That's yeah. how you know it's here.
Yeah. Grey's Anatomy, they come here one time a year.
You know, could you imagine if Grey's Anatomy had decided to set up camp and actually shoot all, what, 14 whatever seasons they've had in Seattle?
A lot of
what
people
that would
have
done to the Seattle film scene.
It would have been great. It would have been great because like the was it World War or no Z Nation?
Yeah, Z Nation.
Like that
and
really
Spokane.
That really sparked Spokane's film scene, and that's like a piece of crap asylum show.
So. Yeah, and there's a period there. There's like two or three TV series being shot down in Portland and just exploded down there.
Totally.
Leverage and that one about the guy who
Portlandia
sees
too.
Monsters or something like that.
Oh yeah. Oh my God. Yeah.
Steve
Grimm.
Was in it. Graham. Yeah, Graham.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
All shot in Portland.
I wish. Mm-hmm. We need to get our shit together. I know we're making infinitely tiny baby steps towards actually being a city where people care about film, but yeah. we would have a much better economy if we did. But
I agree. Okay, well, speaking of economy, this is where I thank everybody for participating in the Value for Value model. And liking, sharing posts, donating money, racing to see who can share the episode being released first. I always right. love that. What am I missing, guys? Do we have anything else? Are we done?
Yeah.
I think that's it.
All right. Okay. We're coming back in 1 week and we are talking. I'll have to figure out what to call this.
What I wrote was
hometown horror.
Genre but. Film shot in or located near hometown.
There we go.
Beautiful. Really has a ring to it.
Yeah,
all right. Adios, muchachos.
See ya.
Bye.
Transportation and other considerations for Strange Eons Radio produced by Pan Am Airlines. When you think of traveling, think of Pan Am. You can't beat the experience. Guests of Strange Eons Radio stay at Econo Lodge Everett. It's an easy stop on the road. You know what I mean? Strange Eons Radio is recorded live in front of a studio audience. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider leaving us a positive review on your favorite podcast app. Sit, Ubu, sit.
Wow, how did you mess up the hello?